You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a doctor's visit can feel complicated for anyone, but for a transgender or gender non-conforming person, it can be degrading and uncomfortable. We'll learn more about what the healthcare system could do to support all individuals from a Wisconsin doctor. First, have you ever stopped to think about how much you use Google, say, every day, or Apple or Amazon? It's probably not surprising to hear that these big technology companies have a pretty big reach, but our next guest says it's actually a lot bigger than you might think. Kashmir Hill is a reporter and deputy editor for special projects at Gizmodo Media. She recently tried cutting the five big technology companies out of her life: Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Facebook. Kashmir, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, my pleasure.
What led you, as a technology reporter, to try to cut these key technology companies one at a time out of your life?
Well, these companies have been getting a lot of criticism lately for a variety of things, but maybe being too powerful, having bad labor practices, being privacy invasive, you know, spreading disinformation, misinformation. And sometimes critics are told, okay, well, if you don't like the company, just stop using their products. And so I wanted to do this experiment to find out if that was possible. And I found out that it's not.
Right. And it is harder than it sounds. And let's take Amazon as one example, because it sounds like easy. Okay, if you shop at Amazon, you just stop shopping at Amazon for that week. Easy peasy. But what you discovered was that our lives intersect with Amazon in many unexpected ways.
Right. I didn't want to just boycott their products. I didn't want to just like stay out of Whole Foods and not order from Amazon.com. I wanted to actually really prevent myself from interacting with Amazon in any way. So I worked with a technologist who built a virtual private network, or VPN for me, that actually blocked any of my devices from communicating with Amazon servers. And so it wasn't Amazon.com that was hard to avoid, or Twitch.com, or Whole Foods, or the things that we know that they own. It was hard to avoid Amazon Web Services, or AWS, which is, a lot of people don't know about it, but it is like the backbone of the web. They do web hosting for really the majority of websites and apps, and it's actually the most profitable part of Amazon. They make more money off of that than their retail business.
And you found that even if you try to use things you think of as rivals to Amazon, or in some cases, government information services, you were encountering Amazon.
Right. Yeah. During the week that I was blocking Amazon, there was basically no options for digital entertainment. All of the video streaming sites, including Netflix, which is a competitor of Amazon, they didn't work because they all rely on AWS for hosting.
Was, of the five you cut out, again, one at a time, and then you did them all at once, we'll get to that in a bit, but was there one that felt like, okay, this is having a personal impact on you the most?
Like every company, there was something very challenging about blocking it. You know, personally, it was a little hard for me with Apple, just because I'm so kind of addicted to Apple products, and it's pretty hard to get out of their walled garden. And then, I mean, Facebook, I thought it would be a nice break from social media, but I really did lose the ability to kind of mass communicate with my community. And, you know, I missed that one of my closest friends had a baby until, you know, days later when I got back on Facebook and I contacted her and said, you know, congratulations, I'm so sorry I'm late here, I didn't know you had your daughter. And she said, oh, well, I just assume if I put something on Facebook, everyone's going to see it. So yeah, there were different challenges to each. Google was hard because once I blocked Google, it's one, slowed down the entire internet for me, because so many websites rely on resources for Google, and Google is just an absolute behemoth when it comes to maps. So there were a lot of services that didn't work. I couldn't use Uber or Lyft to get around because I couldn't enter my destination without accessing Google Maps.
Talking to Kashmir Hill with Gizmodo Media, talking about her experiment cutting the five big technology companies out of her life one at a time: Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Facebook, and then the big finish, all of them at the same time. Kashmir, we don't always say Microsoft in the same breath as all these other companies. You write in part that was because of antitrust action against them some years ago, but we intersect with Microsoft invisibly a lot, even if we don't think of ourselves as really online connected people, you discovered.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Microsoft used to be kind of like a big technology supervillain because it was so dominant when computers were first being created. It was the operating system on like all the computers, and it was forcing them to, you know, offer Internet Explorer for free, and the government kind of smashed them down and went after them for violating antitrust. And it led to the birth of these companies that are now dominant, like, you know, Google and Facebook and Amazon. And so I thought, oh, it'll be easy to avoid Microsoft. And it was as a consumer. I use Skype and LinkedIn quite a bit, which they own, but I was able to avoid them for a week. What was harder was to avoid Microsoft in the real world, because it still does have a place of dominance in the services that businesses use and the services that governments use. So when I went to use the public transportation here, the BART, which is our subway, you know, I noticed that there's Windows error messages on the machines in the system because they're still using Windows. So yeah, I mean, you might say that the technology is a bit dated, but it is still around.
So you did these one at a time, but then you wrapped it up trying going out without all of these five. And you are a person on the spectrum of being connected to online and internet stuff. You're pretty connected. What was it like to go without all the services of these five companies for a week?
There were some big challenges. One of the hardest things was that was finding a phone that I could use, because Apple and Google have basically a duopoly in the smartphone market. And so I couldn't find a phone that was commercially available, a smartphone that was commercially available that I could use. So I had to go back to using a dumb phone, a Nokia 3310 that, you know, has T9 texting. It just has like 12 buttons and you use the number buttons to text. And so I was basically just using it for calling and texting. I mean, I couldn't use a lot of the web. The camera on my Nokia was terrible. So I had this point and shoot digital camera from Canon, but then I was like, why should I take photos? Where am I going to share them? So it was just a week in which I did a lot of communicating by phone calls just because texting was so annoying. And I kind of didn't go anywhere I wasn't super familiar with, because I didn't have access to mapping apps. So it was kind of like a quiet week where I spent a lot of time, you know, with my people I know, with my daughter, with my husband. And it was kind of nice in a way to get away from the technology, but it's hard to be a normal person in the world who needs to be connected when you're trying to block the tech giants.
And did you feel a takeaway in terms of how powerful these five companies are, how huge their reach is into so many different parts of our lives?
Yeah, I mean, it's really incredible the degree to which these companies are just fundamental to the infrastructure of the internet, of the web, but also of just commerce now in the United States. You know, I was trying to avoid Amazon, and so I ordered a package from their competitor, eBay. And when it came in the mail a couple of days later, it was in an Amazon yellow package with like the smiley arrow. And it's because the eBay seller uses fulfillment by Amazon. They keep their product in an Amazon warehouse and they rely on Amazon to ship it. So I just got this sense of how much these companies have grown and entered different markets. And I mean, really dominate them to a great extent where you just can't avoid them. And I think it raises questions about how powerful they're getting and what they could do with that power and that data that they're collecting, and whether regulators should be looking more closely at them like they did at Microsoft in the 1990s.
Kashmir, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing this experiment with us.
Thank you.
Kashmir Hill is a reporter and deputy editor for special projects at Gizmodo Media Group. She was with us to talk about her experience banning the five big technology companies from her life. Coming up, for patients identifying as LGBTQ, going to a doctor's visit can be scary. We'll talk with a doctor who specializes in treating LGBTQ patients about how our healthcare system could be more inclusive. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some analysts fear a new arms race after the U.S. and Russia both pulled out of a nearly 30-year-old treaty. We'll get the latest on nuclear arms agreements and disagreements. First, many of us might put off paying a visit to the doctor for one reason or another, but for LGBTQ patients, there can be even more anxiety surrounding a doctor's visit. Dr. Kathy Oriel is a family doctor at her own private practice, Oriel Medicine, located in Madison. She specializes in treating LGBTQ patients and has 20 years of prior experience in the UW healthcare system. She joins us now in our studio. Dr. Oriel, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So, talking to your patients, past and present, what kind of concerns have you heard from people about their experiences in the healthcare system if they're lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or non-binary?
Oh, okay. That's kind of a career's worth of question, but let me try to focus. And let me really focus on trans and non-binary people first. And the thing that I think that most folks aren't aware of is that it is absolutely legal currently in Wisconsin for healthcare insurers to say, we won't cover any services related to gender. So we won't cover hormones, we won't cover counseling related to gender, and we're certainly not going to cover any surgeries. So that's one thing. I mean, just blatant non-coverage of services that every major medical association agrees are without question therapeutic and medically necessary.
And then how about just treatment once, setting aside the payment, which is a big deal, treatment in the medical system? It sounds like it varies widely.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, the majority of people in healthcare are there because they want to provide good care. But certainly we all come with our own biases. And, you know, especially in big systems where you're checking in at the front desk and then you're checking in the back with a second receptionist and then you've got the nurse, to have to explain to people over and over why the name you prefer to be called is not what's written on your chart and the way you appear may not match the gender marker in the chart is just emotionally exhausting. And I mean, most people don't find healthcare settings really comfortable places to be anyways.
Right, because you're in theory coming in with something that you're stressed about to begin with, quite apart from the issues you just mentioned. Anybody going to a doctor, they're there not just for fun.
Let's be clear. And the same sort of biases, I would say, regarding gender, regarding sexual orientation. The other piece of the work I do is as a board-certified addiction medicine doctor, so people struggling with substances. Doctors, nurses, healthcare providers may still make judgments about people until they've really heard their story.
Is there something about it seems like we have larger and larger healthcare systems with more and more need to, put it in the electronic records and things like that. Is there just something structural there built in that makes it harder to hear that personal story, whether it's being non-binary or whether it's addiction?
Well, again, okay, I don't want to sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but it used to be when there was personal information that I wanted to remember. For instance, had a gay man who was a parent. I would write in the inside of the Manila chart what that partner's name is. But because I knew that that person, because of their sexual orientation, could lose parental rights, I didn't put that in the formal medical record. Now with an electronic medical record, which again has many safety advantages, you can actually put a word in and search for any word. Cocaine. You know, somebody's been clean and sober for 15 years and you search cocaine and all of a sudden they've got stigma. So those are some of the concerns.
Talking to Dr. Kathy Oriel with the private practice Oriel Medicine, talking about treating transgender and non-binary patients and maybe how the healthcare system can do better. So talk about when you set off on your own, not an easy thing to do in this day and age in the doctoring business for any reason. What were some of the things you were going to try to focus on?
Well, you know, one of the things that I really wanted to do is get back to a more personalized model. And especially when you're taking care of vulnerable people, it's really nice that the folks who greet them know their name and know their story. I also had concerns regarding the way, now the medical term is called gender dysphoria, and that is a psychiatric terminology that says dysphoria, meaning people are unhappy with certain parts of the body they currently have. Now, a very witty patient of mine said, well, I'm not gender dysphoric anymore. I'm gender euphoric. And what was happening is that I was being told that I needed to include that diagnosis during visits that really didn't have anything to do with gender. Literally last week, a patient of mine who transitioned 15 years ago, so you put 10 men in a line, you could not tell which man this person is, went to the urgent care because he had a leg injury. And I had been very careful in his medical record, and I'm very careful in general to try not to put pejorative language in. But at the urgent care, with his leg pain, it said, reason for visit, one, leg pain. Reason number two, gender identity disorder. And I thought, didn't have anything to do with what gender he was.
Do you have advice? I mean, one solution is to go off and start a separate practice. Do you have, not everybody's going to do that. Not everybody's going to go to that practice. Do you have advice for larger healthcare providers on how they can maybe overcome some of these issues of stigma, of these particular medical codes you were just talking about?
Yeah, you know, and I think we've moved a really long way. I know that certainly just within Madison, very fortunately, most healthcare systems acknowledge that this is medically necessary care. So that's really important. You know, the UW now has a surgeon who's doing gender confirmation surgery. The pediatric physicians at UW have a clinic for kids. I think just asking folks, you know, what name do you prefer to be called? And having little signs that just say, this is a safe space, are incredibly powerful for folks.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Mark on the line in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hi. I'm a hospice chaplain. And recently I posted an article about end-of-life care for LGBTQ people, and one of the members of the group just absolutely went right-wing conservative crazy, and I was so sad. And I'm wondering how somebody like myself, I'm not in private practice, but how does a person get out there so people know there's a safe place for them to come?
Wow. I mean, that's a great question. I think some of the open-ended questions that can be helpful for anyone are, you know, who's supportive of you? Who are the important people in your life? Those are very generalized questions that can then get, you know, to who they want to be involved. You know, this is a huge issue as well in medical treatment center, or excuse me, addiction treatment centers, which very, for understandable reasons, tend to be very gendered. So I think, again, small signals, as cliche as they are now, like rainbow flags, and there are some other gender welcoming signs that can be used, can just, again, de-escalate people's anxiety in a way that's really helpful.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Oriel, as we start to wrap up, what advice do you have if there's a healthcare practitioner listening right now and they don't know how to approach issues related to, say, a transgender patient, whether it's for that leg or for a gender-related issue? What would you say to them?
You know, I think the first thing is to acknowledge, thank you for letting me know about this. And that really recognizes the courage of a trans or non-binary person to share with a healthcare provider that information. The second thing is to not run out of the room and freak out. That happens. So to say, hey, I want to help you be your best self, and I don't have that information right now, but I'll get back to you with resources and we'll get you to somebody who can help you help meet your needs.
Dr. Oriel, thanks a lot for joining us today in the studio.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Kathy Oriel is a family doctor at her own private practice, Oriel Medicine. She joined us to talk about providing health care to transgender people. Coming up, we'll take a look at the global nuclear weapons landscape after the U.S. and Russia pulled out of a long-standing arms treaty. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, go on a journey of discovery and visit the lakes of Wisconsin. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of A Lakeside Companion tomorrow morning at 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, some analysts say they're worried about a new arms race between the U.S. and Russia after both countries pulled out of a Cold War missile agreement last week. The U.S. announced its withdrawal from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, saying Russia has been violating the terms for years. Russia says it's been in compliance and that if the U.S. is done with the treaty, Russia is out too. Meanwhile, during this week's State of the Union address, President Trump said he would meet again with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un at the end of the month. The talks are part of the administration's effort at nuclear disarmament in that country. Sarah Krebs is a professor of government and adjunct professor of law at Cornell University and an Air Force veteran. She's also the author of Taxing Wars, The American Way of War Finance, and The Decline of Democracy. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, can you start by telling us about this treaty on intermediate range nuclear missiles between the U.S. and Russia?
Right. So during the Cold War, there was a growing sense, you know, especially the 80s, that the nuclear apocalypse may be nigh. And so, especially, I think, given the rapport between Reagan and Gorbachev, they initiated a series of arms control agreements. And so this was one in a series that was negotiated, concluded, and ratified during the 1980s. And it's been in place, obviously, for several decades now. And so I think there's been a lot of sort of hand-wringing among the non-proliferation community about what this means that the U.S. has withdrawn from the treaty, and so I can understand that there are a lot of concerns about what this means for non-proliferation, you know, not just between the United States and Russia, but sort of the ripple effects beyond.
And on the American side, people have been saying, well, Russia is in violation of this treaty, so it's a pretense to stay in it. Is that accurate? Has Russia been in violation of the terms of that treaty?
Well, they have. And this is something that the Obama administration had identified several years ago and they had put into writing. And what I think this gets at is just different philosophies about how to sort of exert power and influence in international relations, and whether you do that sort of from the inside of an organization or treaty, or that you do that from the outside. And one perspective would suggest that by staying in a treaty that is fatally flawed, all you're doing is legitimizing a bad agreement, and that the best way to do it is to withdraw and negotiate a new agreement that sort of is more consistent and compatible with where these two countries are today. And I think that that's sort of the theory, such as it is, that the Trump administration is operating on. I mean, I would just add, too, that, and this is sort of a bigger question in a way, is that, you know, it reminds me of what President Bush did in early in his administration when he withdrew from the ABM treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And, you know, what that did is it set the stage for actually arguably a more solid treaty in 2002, the Moscow Treaty between the United States and Russia, that, you know, arguably was the result of a sort of strengthened bargaining hand because the U.S. was withdrawn from the ABM Treaty. So I think that this may be, you know, if I could sort of ascribe the word strategy to it, it could be a strategy that the Trump administration has envisioned.
Along those lines, President Trump mentioned this during his State of the Union address. Here's Alyssa.
Perhaps we can negotiate a different agreement, adding China and others, or perhaps we can't, in which case we will outspend and out-innovate all others by far.
So let's take that one piece at a time. The idea that, okay, forget this bilateral agreement. We need to negotiate with Russia and China and maybe others. Is it easier, harder to have more than two parties at the table to negotiate an intermediate nuclear weapons treaty?
Well, so I think that there's an obvious trade-off between kind of the effectiveness and the difficulty of negotiating that treaty. So, I mean, I will say I think there's a valid point that a treaty between the U.S. and Russia is an anachronism given the rising power of China. So if one thinks that this is a proliferation issue, then the key players need to be involved and China needs to be involved. Now, it's a different story to see how you can actually negotiate that kind of agreement, but there is an argument to be made that China should be part of any major nuclear agreement of that nature.
And part two of that statement, if we don't negotiate this multilateral agreement, we can win, we can outspend and out-innovate in effect, I guess, in arms race. Is that true? Could we?
Well, I mean, I don't want to sort of be flip about this, but I mean, the U.S. already spends $700 billion on defense every year. So it's outspending essentially every other country combined on defense. So, I mean, I guess the answer is yes. I don't think it needs to increase spending to achieve that because it's already achieving that. But it does also sort of sound reminiscent of the Cold War, the sort of Reagan military buildup will just outspend them. And, you know, there are debates about whether that's what brought the end of the Cold War or other factors. But I think that's probably what he's thinking when he makes that kind of statement. But I do find it sort of interesting, too, that somewhat puzzling strategy about kind of what it means to be withdrawing from some of the international commitments that the U.S. is making, but also, meanwhile, promising to spend far more money. So I think that there are some interesting and potential incompatibilities here.
Talking to Sarah Krebs, professor at Cornell University, about nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons treaties, as the U.S. and Russia withdraw from one three-decade-old treaty on intermediate-range nuclear weapons. Sarah, can you talk about this particular category of weapon a little bit and how people see it as a threat in terms of nuclear war and as a deterrent?
Well, so I think, you know, again, in the Cold War, there were various classes of nuclear weapons, and without getting too much into the weeds on any of this, I mean, I think the key thing is that this was a category of nuclear weapons that was seen to be destabilizing for both sets of parties. And, you know, so they had, you know, SALT was a strategic arms limitation talks, SALT 1, SALT 2, and then sort of a series of agreements in the in that Reagan era of the 80s And this was meant to be sort of that intermediate range nuclear forces agreement that would address that category.
Now, as a kid in the 80s, nuclear war seemed like this very present threat. The day after movie, TV movie scared
right,
the heck
right.
out of all of us.
Including Reagan, I might add.
Right, right. Yeah, definitely. Now, this was a looming issue. Are we not paying enough attention to it now? We still have lots of nuclear weapons in the hands of maybe not adversaries, but rival countries around the world.
Well, so again, I think this is sort of underlying the strategy, if you will, of withdrawing from the agreement in the sense that if you think about it, the major arms control agreements in the Cold War were between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And the geostrategic sort of landscape looks so different today. I mean, so again, you can't have an effective agreement that doesn't include the rising China. And so I think that there has to be some consideration given to that changing landscape. How to actually carry that out, I think, is a very different story, just given China's reticence in international organizations, international treaties, its tendency to think in terms of kind of non-intervention, sort of protection of sovereignty kinds of things. I mean, so I think you see this. One of the other issues I work on quite a bit is drones. And so the major agreement that regulates the transfer of drones is the MTCR, the Missile Control Treaty Regulation, MTCR. And that was actually a Cold War treaty that was meant, the late 80s also, it was meant to regulate the transfer of technologies that could be used as nuclear delivery devices. Well, drones were considered one of those. But China's not in that agreement either. And yet China's one of the major producers and exporters of drones. And so I think there are a lot of agreements like this that, you know, are somewhat anachronistic given that China is a major player today.
Have there been efforts in the current administration, previous administrations, to negotiate directly with China over nuclear weapon-related issues?
So, you know, they've been part of the multilateral negotiations like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty that failed in the 1990s. So they're sort of part of multilateral agreements, but not as much sort of the trial. And of course, they're part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The NPT is one of the nuclear countries. So they are a part of some, but they haven't been sort of as integral to the more contemporary ones. And for some reason, and again, this might just be an anachronism, that these major treaties have been between the U.S. and Russia. I mean, in some ways, it still makes sense. China has, let's say, 200 in its arsenal compared to about the 1,500 that the U.S. and Russia have. So still, as a percentage, China is comparatively low. But I think as sort of the total number combined with their rising power, it really behooves the international community, especially Russia and the United States, to start incorporating them into these negotiations.
We're talking about nuclear weapons with Sarah Krebs. She's a professor of government and adjunct professor of law at Cornell University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the U.S. and then Russia pulling out of this particular treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty? How concerned are you about a new nuclear arms race? In just a few minutes, we'll talk about North Korea as well. What do you make of the president's handling of North Korean issues? And do you have a question about all this stuff for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about recent nuclear weapons news with Sarah Krebs, professor of government and adjunct professor of law at Cornell University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the collapse of a nuclear weapons treaty between the U.S. and Russia? Do you have questions about what's going on in Korea? President Trump saying he's going to meet again with the leader of North Korea. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's turn to North Korea. President Trump, as we mentioned in the State of the Union address, saying he would hold a second meeting with Kim Jong-un, North Korean leader. That's scheduled to happen at the end of the month in Vietnam. Here's the president talking about progress in North Korea.
Our hostages have come home. Nuclear testing has stopped. and there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months. If I had not been elected President of the United States, we would right now, in my opinion, be in a major war with North Korea.
Sarah, what do you make of the current state of negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea over the nuclear program in North Korea?
Well, I think it's progress in the sense that this time last year, I did a screening of last year's State of the Union with my undergrads, and they said, "Professor, are we going to war with North Korea?" And I was, I was actually not fearful of that prospect, but I think there was this sense that there would be kind of an imminent war with North Korea. And yet I think what we see today is progress towards, I wouldn't go so far as denuclearization. I think that's a fairly ambitious outcome that I don't think anyone can attain. But I think sitting down with this leader and trying to make moves toward a at least more transparent and controlled, regulated situation is clearly progress. And I think he's moved in that direction. I think in the interim time since the Singapore summit last year, there have been a lot of negotiations going on behind the scenes. It's obviously hard to see what those are, but my sense and my understanding talking to people who are familiar with that world is that they've been making incremental progress. It's setting the groundwork for the meeting later this month.
Go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Adam is with us in Madison. Adam, hi.
Hi, yeah, is there a question about technology and regulations about, very accurate GPS and who has access to that and how much access and just how that plays into this? I mean, I imagine it's very important because you would need high-quality GPS, and then countries have control over certain satellites. So I'm just curious about your thoughts. Thanks.
Adam, thanks for the call, Sarah. That's not a connection I was familiar with, but GPS, satellites, and I guess missile targeting, is that something you're tracking?
No pun intended, right? So that's interesting in the sense that one thing that I think some observers thought that Trump would talk about the other night was his proposed Space Force. And I think that sort of plugs into that proposal for the Space Force in a way, which is sort of this sense that we need better protection of kind of the satellites and better control of that. I guess it's all sort of part and parcel of the same thing. I'm not clear as to sort of how that can be regulated and controlled. I mean, I think it ties into a lot of concerns, which, whether it's the control, I just mentioned drones. Obviously, these GPS satellites, if they sort of get not hijacked, but sort of hacked into, are a major vulnerability for a country like the United States.
Thanks for the call, Adam. We'll go now to Scott in Wausau. Scott, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Great show. I was just wondering if you could comment on the use of tactical nuclear weapons in a conventional war mm-hmm. setting. There was an article, mm-hmm. actually a mm-hmm. full magazine by Foreign Affairs that talked about this, that Russia and even China may use a tactical nuclear weapon in a conventional war setting, such as a bombing a U.S. base. And would the United States deter, or would they proceed with a full-scale nuclear attack if that would occur? It kind of goes into, are we willing to risk the entire world on one small nuclear attack versus a large scale? I don't know if you can comment on that.
Yeah, well, it's a good question because when the Trump administration released the nuclear posture review last year, there was a move toward kind of resuscitating tactical nuclear weapons to kind of keep there are a number of ways in which, we're hearing themes of kind of a revived arms race, Cold War situation. And that comment you just heard about, we're going to outspend them, is one of those. But this is another, which is Russia has always had an advantage on the tactical nuclear weapons side. I mean, always in all of these historical arms control treaties, there was always that concern. Well, what about Russia's or Soviet Union's tactical nuclear arsenal? They still have that advantage. And in this NPR, the Nuclear Posture Review, there was this this move to kind of renew the U.S. interest to make nuclear weapons more usable. And the concern is that if you don't have tactical sort of these battlefield nuclear weapons, you have unusable nuclear arsenal because it's too high yield. And there's a sense that, well, you can't use a large-scale nuclear weapon in a battlefield setting. And therefore, all of deterrence falls apart if they don't believe that you would actually use a nuclear weapon. So therefore, you need to go lower level. You can see, though, how this all of sort of the stability unravels if now suddenly we're seeming as though we're putting nuclear weapons in play. So that line between deterrence and usability in a sort of destabilizing sense becomes very thin. And I think that's, in the non-proliferation community, sort of the concern about making tactical or making nuclear weapons more usable by going tactical is that double-edged sword, where it does make them more usable and deterrent, but also the usability also increases the risk of a sort of a large-scale confrontation.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call. Sarah, in our last couple minutes, we've talked a lot about the U.S. and Russia. You've talked about China some, North Korea. Are there other parts of the world that you're paying close attention to when it comes to nuclear weapons proliferation and possible use?
Well, I think the one that gets a lot of attention is Iran. And so that's one where I think the administration has been taking a sort of harder line, a much harder line than we had seen with the Obama administration, obviously withdrawing from the Iran agreement and sort of this this sense that we can't, that they're sort of not complying. And, you know, I think this raises some questions of consistency in a way, which is, you know, the U.S. is engaging in these negotiations with North Korea, and there's some question about whether we can verify steps toward denuclearization. And if one buys that argument that you can sort of press and verify, then why is there not that view with respect to Iran? Like, and so I think that hasn't been clearly articulated, other than perhaps that the Middle East is just sort of idiosyncratic and different, and that the sort of threat of Iran having nuclear weapons in a region with Israel, you know, close ally Israel, just makes the stakes higher.
Does pulling out briefly of the Iran treaty make it more or less likely, though, that Iran ends up with those nuclear weapons?
So, I think it depends on who you talk to. My own view is that being in an agreement with them where we have some sort of grounds for verification and inspections is a better place to be than having withdrawn from the treaty and having no leverage at all.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. It was great to be here.
Sarah Krebs is a professor of government and adjunct professor of law at Cornell University. We talked with her about the U.S. and Russia pulling out of a decades-old nuclear weapons treaty, along with other global nuclear developments in places like North Korea and Iran. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new Bloomberg Business Report shows a lot of downside for Wisconsin's deal with the technology company Foxconn. We'll have the investigative reporter behind that piece with us on the show. He'll tell us what he found, what he's hearing from people in the industry, and you can share your questions and reactions along the way. There are large-scale efforts to turn the tide on opioid addiction in the United States. But our guest says the crackdown is hurting patients with serious chronic pain. She's a chronic pain sufferer herself. She advocates for people with chronic pain, and she says people who need opioid medications to function on a daily basis aren't getting them. We'll hear her story. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. If the cold weather has you down, try baking some bread. Our guest baker helps us get started with advice for the first-time bread maker and answers your questions. Who knows, maybe they'll even get me to finally try my hand at bread baking. I wouldn't count on it, but if you want to make some and bring it in for me, I will gladly eat that fresh bread. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 7, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests take a look at President Trump's policies on tariffs and how they're affecting American businesses and consumers. That's tomorrow at 7 on the morning show. Up next, it's news for NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, these days, we're quick to occupy our kids with a phone app or some other form of entertainment. But our guest says we might benefit with a little less excitement and that we should let children get bored. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.